People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Hello and welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. The best place on earth. That was British Columbia's slogan for a while. It even showed up on license plates leading up to the Vancouver Olympics. Around the same time, Dania Fast was embarking on a project that would span the next 15 years of her life. Her goal was to hear from young people who use drugs and live in poverty, to hear what they thought about Vancouver. She spoke with hundreds of people. Several youth would stay in regular contact with Fast for more than a decade. They'd meet up in her office, in coffee shops, wherever the youth were staying at the time. Sometimes they'd travel the city together to take photographs. Over the years, the research and relationships would evolve. People would move through various forms of housing or treatment programs. Couples would separate and get back together. Fentanyl would enter the drug supply. Fast has compiled the stories and perspectives of around 25 of the youth she followed into a book. It's called The Best Place: Addiction, Intervention, and Living and Dying Young in Vancouver. Many of those Fast spoke with would die during the course of the research. The book is dedicated to their memory. Today on the show, we're going to learn more about The Best Place.
I'm Dania Fast. I am a medical anthropologist by training. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at UBC here in Vancouver, and also a research scientist at the BC Center on Substance Use. And I've been working with young people who use drugs primarily in the context of unstable housing and homelessness since late 2007. And those young people, of course, I got to know them in Metro Vancouver, but they really do come from all across the province, including the island and really all across Canada, actually.
Before we get into maybe the meat of our discussion, I want to address something that I know you put a lot of thought into during your research, and that's what we're going to be talking about today is built from very specific details of people's lives. Can you tell me what considerations went along with that for you?
Well, I wanted to do justice to these relationships that I'd formed with these young people over so many years. You know, the timelines varied with each person, but in some cases it was many, many years, over a decade for some folks. And so I wanted to do justice to those relationships and to, you know, the closeness that I had with these young people, and to really bring to life those details of their lives that I was there to witness and also that we talked about over many years. But I also wanted to be very, very careful about anonymizing young people. So a lot of those small details have been changed in small ways, not in any ways that would change the conclusions that might be drawn from the book. But I did certainly change some of those details to make sure that young people remained anonymous.
You started this out as a project where you were hoping to learn about sense of place. So basically how youth experiencing homelessness saw themselves in Vancouver, maybe what they thought about the place Vancouver. At one point you wrote that the people you spoke with wanted to talk about Vancouver as one of the best places on earth and to imagine where they were going next in it. What can you tell me about maybe the goals that the youth you spoke to shared?
So that was my PhD project. I wanted to examine young people's senses of place in the city in the context of homelessness and unstable housing and intensive substance use. And of course, these were young people who were really inhabiting the margins of urban space. A lot of them were sleeping outside, or they were staying at shelters. Some of them were, you know, sort of couch hopping, couch surfing. And so I think I went in with this expectation of, okay, I'm going to hear about life in the margins. I'm going to hear about homelessness and unstable housing and poverty and, you know, maybe what it takes to survive in that context. And instead, the young people who I was working with and building these relationships with, you know, they often didn't want to talk about that. They wanted to talk about Vancouver as one of the best places on earth, this beautiful city full of promise and opportunity. And so that's where the title of the book comes from, of course, is this license plate that was actually for the province of British Columbia around the time of the 2010 Winter Olympic Games, which I believe read the best place on earth. And so young people would sometimes reference that. They'd say, hey, you know, Vancouver is the best place on earth, just like the license plates say. And so that's why I called the book The Best Place, because so many of the young people I worked with, even though they were living and sleeping outside, even though they were inhabiting the margins of the city and were in so many ways excluded from the city, they nevertheless, many of them had this deep desire to situate themselves as a part of the city, as a part of the city's beauty and promise and opportunity. So that really shifted my research focus, actually. And as so many young people started sort of correcting me and saying, hey, you know, no, we don't want to talk about street smarts. We don't want to talk about a street youth community. We want to talk about the city of Vancouver and the kinds of lives we're going to build for ourselves within it. Then I really took my research in that direction.
Yeah. And could you share maybe a bit about what those kinds of lives that people expressed that they wanted to build, like what was the ideal vision or the dreams, maybe, if you will, that people talked about having?
Yeah. So a whole section of the book, of course, is called Dreams of Place. And was very interested in these dreams and all their variations, but in some ways they were all quite similar and they were all quite conventional and really, you know, reflected things that I think many of us aspire to in the city. So young people, you know, they longed for homes, whether that was a basement suite, an apartment, or even a house in the city. They wanted exciting careers. They wanted to engage in various kinds of leisure activities. So, you know, they would imagine going skiing on the North Shore Mountains or going hiking. They talked about things like, you know, getting that paycheck every 2 weeks into a bank account. We spent so much time talking about, you know, finding your romantic soulmate and, you know, getting married, having kids, having pets. So even though these young people were quite young, you know, in many cases in their teens when I met them, they really were looking forward to that family unit that they wanted to create with a romantic soulmate and, you know, one or more kids and a pet.
And I think there was something from my experience reading the book, something deeply affecting about reading that. And then in the same section of the book, reading as well that, you know, folks would meet up with you and it would be exciting because it would open up sections of the city. They would be able to, say, go to a fancy seeming coffee shop and spend a few minutes without worrying that someone was going to come up and kick them out. I don't know, what was it like experiencing that firsthand?
Well, I think, you know, it's really important to acknowledge, you know, I was bringing certain kinds of desires to the research encounter, and young people were also bringing desires to the research encounter, and we were both wanting particular things from each other. So, of course, I was doing my PhD, working to advance my education, and young people, you know, deeply desired proximity, I think, to this version of a normal life that they so deeply desired that I really in so many ways reflected back to them. So, you know, earlier I was talking about these relationships that I formed with many of these young people. And I don't want to diminish that because I think there were real friendships, real relationships between us. But I also think, you know, we were bringing these desires to that encounter and both, you know, getting something out of this research process. And what they often seem to be getting out of it, in addition to forming this friendship across, you know, in many cases, quite a vast difference in privilege, was they were getting this proximity to the sort of life that they aspired to. So, you know, spending time with me meant we could go to what they referred to as nice coffee shops. It meant we could go places in my car that I owned, and, you know, they could use my iPhone while we were driving around in that car to play music. You know, we even went and as we were undertaking this photography project, this photo essay project, we even went to the North Shore Mountains, you know, and took some photographs of the city from that vantage point. So that was a really interesting part of the research process, how that played out, how sort of, you know, I had my desires that I brought in for, you know, to undertake this kind of project and to, you know, do a project like this to advance my education and my career. And they were bringing this desire for, you know, for sort of a normal life or to situate themselves in the city in a particular way, like as sort of as a part of this normal life, which they could do to an extent through spending time with me. Of course, it was temporary, but it was possible for those times that we were together.
And I feel like going off of that, I don't know, it's maybe such an obvious question. Why was it temporary?
Well, it was temporary because at the end of the day or at the end of the night, whatever time we were spending together, you know, I went back to my apartment in Kitsilano and they went back to the shelter, the single room occupancy hotel, the streets where they were, you know, living and sleeping. And so they had that proximity to that life they so deeply desired while they were in my car or in a coffee shop where I could, you know, purchase us coffees and snacks and things like that. But as soon as we separated, of course, I went back to my life and they went back to theirs. And that's where we, of course, see that stark difference in power and privilege that is also embedded in this kind of research encounter. These are such complicated research encounters because you have these relationships, these close friendships, relationships forming. You have both parties bringing different desires to that encounter, sort of wanting different things out of it. And then you have, you know, the power and privilege that surrounds the whole thing, where the researcher is going back to an apartment in Kitsilano in the car that she owns, and the young person is, you know, potentially going back to the sort of alleyway where they're going to spend the night.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest on today's program is Dania Fast. She spent 15 years meeting with a number of young people who use drugs in Vancouver. Their stories are told in the book, The Best Place. And I do want to ask a bit more about maybe the power and the privilege and what you term in the book, the poverty management infrastructure. But maybe before we get to that, I think the whole point of the research is not to focus on that, is to focus on people's lived experience of being experiencing homelessness while young. I think one of the biggest continuous themes, one of the things you were hoping to study was substance use. And maybe before I bring kind of what I took from the book, I'm just curious, what were some of the things that stood out to you from your experience researching on substance use?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I've done a lot of research on substance use over many, many years. And even so much of my own work over the last 15 years or so in the realm of youth and substance use has focused on risks and harms of substance use and how we can mediate those risks and harms. But when I think about my encounters with young people in the context of this ethnographic work, these relationships, this time spent in the places of their everyday lives, I think what so often surfaced was all of the things that drugs were doing for young people. All of the things that drugs were opening up for them rather than what drugs were closing down. So in the book, I didn't want to sanitize any of the risks and harms. I didn't want to write that out, but I really wanted to foreground, okay, here's what crystal meth is opening up for young people. Here's what heroin and later fentanyl is opening up for young people. Here's what these things are doing for them. Because I think that that answers a really important question, especially in the context of the current overdose crisis. You know, we know that drugs are so tremendously dangerous right now. We have such a contaminated drug supply. You know, we have overdose numbers that were unimaginable 10 years ago, including for very young people between 10 and 18. And as I continue to work with young people, I know that many of them know just how dangerous drugs are. So why do people keep using them? Why do people continue to use meth and heroin and seek out fentanyl and use these things, even though we know, as some of the young people in the book talked about, you know, that using these things intensively can mean that you're really living on the edge of death, as a few young people put it. And I think the book, you know, answers some of those questions. I hope it does. I hope it shows why someone might continue to use meth, even though they know it could be contaminated with fentanyl and that they could have an overdose really at any time that they're using. So that was my goal in the book, was to take that different perspective, to really look at that opening up as opposed to that closing down.
And certainly, I think that was one of the things that I appreciated in the work and found maybe revelatory, was sometimes it feels like in public, maybe media level discussions, you know, we hear the term substance use or we hear the term addiction without maybe a level of specificity as to what different substances are, what they do, why people might use them. And I found that I was able to get a picture of both at the same time, why people might be turning to, say, meth and what it is doing for them, but at the same time, how it is maybe that cycle is preventing them from achieving their stated goals, or maybe is the biggest obstacle, what feels like sometimes. In the book, you kind of offer this hypothesis or this theory that kind of the chaotic and frenetic nature of chasing after substances, it almost gives some of the people you spoke with a sense of day-to-day purpose in the present moment. And there were a number of times you outlined for people where they maybe were in an SRO and they were trying to get out of a cycle of addiction and they just felt this intense boredom or this like lack of purpose. Is that something you can tell me about?
Yeah, so boredom was also something that emerged so strongly across my work with young people over so many years. And so it was something that I knew I needed to really contend with as I was analyzing this huge amount of material from so many years. Boredom just surfaced again and again, both in terms of conversations I was having with young people, as well as when we were together in the places of their everyday lives. You know, there would be so many moments where people would just say, you know, I'm so bored. This is so boring. And I could feel it too. Like, yeah, this is boring. We've been sitting here for 3 hours, you know, nothing's going on. And it's something that hasn't been looked at, I think, nearly enough in research focused on substance use, but also research focused on poverty, homelessness, and unstable housing. I think, you know, when we're thinking about the lived experience of poverty and homelessness and unstable housing among at least this group of young people who I came to know, boredom is a big part of that lived experience. And of course, I don't mean boredom in the same way that a middle upper class teenager experiences boredom, because I think, you know, middle upper class teenagers do experience boredom, but I think that kind of boredom is quite different than the boredom experienced by young people who have so few material resources at their disposal. It's a painful, almost confusing sense of boredom. And what I saw was that in that context, substance use could really ameliorate that boredom. So, you know, you're bored and you do meth and suddenly it's exciting to kind of rove around the city and, you know, tinker with the things that you have in your room or in your camp. And then, of course, there's that whole cycle of, you know, you do drugs, you come down off of them. And if you're using drugs intensively and experiencing addiction, you need to go get more drugs. And to get more drugs, you need to get money. And to get money, when you're living in extreme poverty, you often need to track down people and go to different places to get that money or engage in different kinds of income generation. Again, I don't want to sanitize any of this. All of this carries with it tremendous risks and harms. But what I heard from young people again and again was that these were the kinds of forces that were animating their lives. This was what was really ameliorating that boredom and giving them this sense of forward momentum. And as you pointed out, what was very, very telling was when young people got off drugs, they went to treatment, they got off drugs, maybe they even got housing in a supportive housing building, let's say. They were on methadone or Suboxone, something like this. They sort of done everything right according to what the professionals in their lives had laid out for them. They often, because the entrenched poverty remained, they often became once again deeply, painfully bored. And in some cases, that really drove them back to the substance use, to those cycles, to the streets. So that was kind of a heartbreaking finding, but also a really important finding, because again, it shows that treatment and housing and abstinence are not in and of themselves the answer. Life needs to have, a lot of people would say life needs to have meaning, it needs to have purpose. Yes, I would also argue it needs to have this sense of forward momentum that many young people actually found in substance use and on the streets.
So is the thing that you maybe took away from that is that the boredom, especially in those circumstances where it felt like people did everything they were expected to do, was the boredom that to reach the place that they said they would hope to be, there were still maybe a ton of steps, or it just wasn't something that was immediately accessible after getting clean, say, quote unquote, that there was no clear pathway from that to the life they wanted to have, which made it tricky.
Right. I mean, I think what became really clear to young people was, okay, you know, I've taken these steps that these professionals have asked me to take. I've taken these steps that I wanted to take. I'm off drugs. I've got housing. I might even be going back to school. I might even have secured, you know, some part-time work. But it wasn't that good life in the best place on earth that many desired. So, you know, youth would reflect on things like, you know, okay, I'm off drugs, I'm on Suboxone, I've got housing, but all of this is so that I can have this crap job, you know, at a retail store. You know, I'm going back to high school, but it seems like there's no way I'm going to be able to go to a university, you know, like you are. They would sort of point to me and go, it doesn't seem like I'm very close at all to where you are. And so, you know, they would notice these things like, okay, I've got housing, but this isn't the housing that I wanted. this is supportive housing. It feels like a hospital. It feels like a jail. It doesn't feel like a real home. And so they would notice these things. And then there was also that crushing boredom in a lot of cases because they didn't have material resources. You know, they couldn't go out and engage in the leisure activities that they, you know, that they had talked about wanting to engage in. And so, yeah, absolutely. There was this disjuncture between where they could get to and where they wanted to get to. And in that context, you know, with sort of those dreams of place unrealized, but also that crushing boredom, some of them did conclude, you know, hey, maybe it's better to go to the streets. You know, maybe, like, why should I stay off the drugs? In some ways, life had more of a sense of momentum and more, you know, kind of eventfulness before. And now I just feel like I'm going nowhere.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
For 15 years, a number of young people living in poverty in Vancouver would meet up with Dania Fast. Even if it was for a research project, the relationships that formed were deeply personal, to use Fast's words. In the book that came out of that research, she traced people's journeys from the street to cold weather shelters, to rundown SROs, to supportive housing sites, to drug treatment centers. The youth's own words and perspectives on their experiences form the backbone of the book. Today on People First Radio, I'm speaking with Dania Fast. The poverty management infrastructure is a phrase that came up a number of times, and how Vancouver has maybe one of the world's most developed poverty management infrastructures. I'm curious, it's come up a few times today so far in our conversation, but what were you able to observe about maybe how that infrastructure, which felt like a character in the book, how that was perceived by the people you were speaking with for your research?
Yeah, and that term, poverty management infrastructure, or at least the poverty management part, I would need to check, actually comes from a group of geographers. So I should give credit where credit's due. But the reason that I was drawn to that term is because the young people I worked with really did feel like they were navigating a sort of infrastructure that was very powerful in determining their lives in the city. And I think in the book, I talk about two infrastructures, right? I talk about the public health and the poverty management infrastructure. And I want to be really clear that research is implicated in both. And by no means do I see myself as outside of those. I really think that I'm fully implicated in both. And I wanted to be really clear about that in the book. I wanted to talk about them as infrastructures to really align with how young people characterize these forces that seem to determine so much of their lives. And also because Vancouver does absolutely have one of the most developed public health and poverty management infrastructures in the entire world. I mean, Vancouver is considered a world leader when it comes to addressing substance use, as well as, you know, homelessness to a point. I think it's recognized that we're in the midst of a very serious housing crisis, but at the same time, we have some housing responses in Vancouver that, you know, are considered very cutting edge globally. And so I wanted to really draw out what those infrastructures looked like, but focusing on the perspectives of young people. So in the book, I spend a relatively short amount of pages providing kind of broad brushstrokes about, for example, how supportive housing emerged in the city, and spend much more time on how young people experienced that move into supportive housing and living in these places. And similarly, I spend a relatively short amount of time describing the emergence of this focus on Suboxone and substance use treatment as one possible solution to the overdose crisis. And then I spend a lot of time focused on how young people experience that scaling up of treatment, and in particular opioid agonist therapy around the declaration of the overdose emergency in 2016. So I find it interesting that you really picked up on that poverty management infrastructure is almost like a character in the book. And I'm just thinking about, you know, does that come alive through sort of young people's perspectives? Because the amount of time I spend sort of describing it from this top-down perspective is relatively short. And then we spend a lot of time learning about how young people sort of live through that move into these places and these years spent in these places.
Exactly. I think that was, again, I think what your research was, I presume, hoping to do was to share these young people's experiences of every kind of aspect of their lives that we would traditionally associate with poverty and youth homelessness. And so to see these systems that are ostensibly there to help people, to see how young people would often view them as forms of control that were not always welcome in their lives, or to see that, you know, people might not draw that large of a distinction between a supportive housing site and, say, jail, was certainly something to read.
Yeah, and these are absolutely unintended consequences. You know, no one who designed supportive housing, I think, was aiming for, you know, let's make this feel like an institution, let's make this feel like jail. And yet that was really these young people's lived experience of these places, at least those were the kinds of words that they use. So,
but at the same time, you do note that, for example, one of them gets used as a set for a police station in Law and Order.
True. Yeah. Yeah. So absolutely. The buildings themselves don't necessarily lend themselves to the sorts of, you know, homemaking that young people were deeply desiring. Absolutely. But I think in hindsight, you know, more work could have been done to design supportive housing in a way that really makes it feel like a home. We missed an opportunity there, because some of the things that young people highlighted are things that I presume we could have done differently. Like, you know, do we need to have fluorescent lighting? Do we need to have all the walls painted white? Do we need to have, you know, meds rooms kind of on the same floors as where people are living, those kinds of things. And I should also note that, you know, as I've done more and more work focused on housing beyond the scope of the book, I want to be really careful to say that supportive housing, and there's lots of different models of it and lots of different agencies running supportive housing. Like, supportive housing may work quite well for some young people. It didn't work well for the young people who I came to know and follow and wrote about in this book. But I certainly don't want to generalize out to all young people, because I've since done quite a large project focused on housing again over the last few years. And I think there's a diversity of perspectives. But for the young people who I followed, who were moving into these very institutional kinds of settings from places that really didn't feel institutional. So they were going from places like the Lighthouse Shelter and some of these other buildings that were really communal and social. And, you know, as young people said, like, we ran things, you know, we did our own thing, we were in charge. They went from that into these very institutional settings. You know, it was devastating for a lot of them. And so we can learn from that, I think. We can learn from the fact that that kind of a transition can be very, very painful for young people.
Another theme that came up a number of times, or in a number of groups of people you spoke to, was being in a couple and the challenges that posed, both in day-to-day life and when interacting with systems where maybe you described that people's moral ethic was kind of based around this whole idea of we need to support each other and we can't abandon each other no matter what. And then that would come up against this idea of you need to go to this specific residential treatment program where you will be away from your partner if you want to get X, Y, or Z form of housing, say, for example.
Yeah, that was a huge issue that emerged. So, you know, going back to the first part of our conversation, these dreams of place that young people had, so often those dreams were anchored by this idea of, you know, forming a romantic relationship with a romantic soulmate and possibly having kids together or having a pet together. Again, these are not dissimilar dreams to, you know, perhaps any teenager, right, who's focused on their romantic relationships. And so then young people find themselves navigating these infrastructures, the poverty management and public health infrastructures. And so much, like so much of what sort of built into those infrastructures seemed to work to separate them. So, for example, when young people were first moved into supportive housing, you know, you weren't officially allowed to share a room with your romantic partner, although exceptions were made, absolutely. But it got really tricky as people had fights and you know, one person potentially got kicked out of the building and barred from the building. And so there were moments within that where young people felt like they were being separated. And then, yes, absolutely, the other example that young people pointed to all the time was, you know, they were told, okay, you have to go to treatment and you have to go to treatment separately from your romantic partner. And in these instances, you know, young people felt like, even when their relationships were tremendously tumultuous, even when, you know, things were very on again, off again within their romantic relationships, nevertheless, those relationships still really did feel like that thing that was anchoring their entire worlds, including their moral worlds, their understandings of what was right and wrong. So as, you know, elements within these infrastructures were sort of working to separate them, you know, again, young people have this confusion, like, you know, this is the one thing that's going to get me through, that's going to, you know, this is this thing that's going to allow me to survive and thrive in this situation that I find myself in. And yet, you know, these various forces are working to separate me. So that was a huge issue. And I think is another area where, you know, we could afford to make some changes. It would be great, and I know how hard this work would be, but it would be great if we could find a way to work together with young couples as opposed to, you know, working with them separately or, you know, mandating periods of separation. Because I think when young people are faced with that, they often do make that decision to stay together no matter what, and the consequences can be really dire.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. In the book, The Best Place, Danya Fast tells the stories of around 24 young people living in poverty in Vancouver over a period of 15 years. Fast formed close relationships with the people who appear under pseudonym in the book. They would meet at Fast's office or spaces that the youth were living in, coffee shops around town, or in her car as they drove somewhere to take pictures for a photo essay project. Today on the program, I'm speaking with Danya Fast about that research and those relationships. Are there any maybe individual moments you spent with people over, you know, this more than a decade of research that really stand out and have stuck with you that you'd like to share with people?
Oh, just, you know, the book is so heavy in terms of the way that it ends. It's, you know, it's so heartbreaking that the end to this book is really the deaths of so many young people as a result of overdoses. And, you know, that was not the book that I set out to write initially. When I finished my PhD in 2013, you know, I was hopeful that I would write a book. And of course, that was 3 years before an overdose emergency was declared. And, you know, everyone with a couple of exceptions, everyone who I had worked with was still alive. And, you know, the book became something different. It had to, and I'm glad that the book is out there because it is a way of keeping these young people's stories out there. And it is a way of keeping these young people who are gone with me and hopefully with others. But I worry that because of, you know, the way that the book changed, that so many moments of laughter and friendship and, you know, all of the really great times that I shared together with young people have gotten lost. So I just want to say that there were so many moments of hilarity and laughing and joking, and that was as much a part of the fieldwork experience as these moments of crisis and these moments of loss that now really, you know, form the end of the book.
And as you describe there, there's maybe, it is a bit of a bleak chronicle. Someone asked me, like, what is the sense of hope? And that is a thing that I was curious about as well. I was looking at it, and I think if you analyze maybe each person's individual story in the book, it's hard to come up with too many examples of people who maybe in 2020 are doing much better than in 2008. I'm curious, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult book in that sense, and I think I even write, at least with one of the young women, you know, I write that I wish this was where the story ended, you know, and not what happened next. And I think with many of the young people I worked with, we all hoped for different endings than are there in the book. So it is really difficult. It's difficult for me to. It was very difficult to write the ending of the book, and it's difficult even to reflect on it now that these are, you know, these are not the endings that most young people wanted or that they imagined for themselves when we first started working together in, you know, 2007, 2008, 2009. For me, the hopefulness in the book is that young people everywhere, including those who are under the weight of all of these structural pressures, poverty, colonialism, racism, young people everywhere dream. They dream those big city dreams. They come to places like Vancouver hoping for better than what they experienced growing up in the places of their childhoods. They see a place for themselves in the city, many of them. They desire a place for themselves. And I do think that we can create a society that creates much more space for them and their dreams. I'm not saying, of course, that everyone is going to own a home in Vancouver. That's out of the reach of, you know, many people, not just the young people in this book. But we can absolutely create a society that makes more space for the kinds of dreams that these young people have, even in terms of funding for programs that gives them much more access to, you know, the leisure activities that they want to take part in the evenings and on the weekends. We can create housing that feels more like a home. We can give people a living wage. so that they do have, some funds to occasionally see a movie or to take up a hobby. We saw that during COVID-19 when the government was able to suddenly give everyone basically $2,000 a month. So there's things that we can do to create more space for these dreams. And I hope that this book can be part of that fight to make Vancouver a more inclusive city.
Yeah, I wanted to ask as well as part of this conversation, you spent this much time talking with people, hearing their lived experience of this experience of being homeless and living in poverty in Vancouver. What are the changes that you would think that we as a society need to make to get there? Is it what you've just outlined? Is there anything else that you'd add to that?
Well, we need a living wage for everyone. We need support for young people and families, way before the sort of stage of life that this book covers. So this book is about, let's say sort of 16-year-olds into kind of early 20s and then follows those young people across time. But for all of the young people I worked with, their marginalization, their exclusion started way earlier. So we need support for families and for young people across the entire life course, like starting probably in utero and moving on from there. We need to build strong communities across the province that support families. And those families, they need a living wage, they need support, they need housing, they need access to leisure and recreation. And for the young people who are in the book and all of the other young people like them who are still alive, of course, we need harm reduction, and we need to address the toxic drug supply. For young people today, now, who are using drugs in Nanaimo, in Vancouver, all across this province, who are at risk of overdose, we need them to have access to places where they can connect with each other, but also with providers who can talk to them about harm reduction, can talk to them about how to use more safely, can connect them with drug testing, with naloxone kits. Those kinds of spaces can also be spaces of leisure, of art, of recreation. So having those places where young people can go and connect and learn about how to use drugs more safely, that is absolutely essential. We really need a regulated drug supply. I'm not sure that anything short of that is going to stop the loss of life that we're seeing as a result of overdoses. So we need to work on multiple fronts. We need to work on like the early childhood piece, the family piece, the community piece. We need to work on the living wage and the housing. And then we also, for those who are using right now, today, we need to work on harm reduction and a regulated drug supply so that, there aren't more books like this where the majority of the people in the book, lose their lives to overdoses as a result of the toxic, unregulated drug supply.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and my guest is Danya Fast. We're discussing The Best Place, Addiction, Intervention, and Living and Dying Young in Vancouver. It's a book that brings together 15 years of relationships between Fast and young people living in poverty in and around British Columbia's largest city. So this is work that you started in 2008 and continued through 2020. I'm just curious about how that evolved over time and specifically the impact of fentanyl and the toxic drug crisis, what it was like before and what changed?
Yeah, I mean, the timeline of this project is so striking because when it began in 2007, 2008, 2009, actually the focus was on HIV and hepatitis C as this big threat. And when I was first hired as a research coordinator and worked in that frontline office that I talked about, that was the kind of work that I was doing. I was looking at young people transitioning into injection drug use and what was shaping that transition. And the whole focus was on the risk of bloodborne infections as a result of transitioning into injecting. And then, of course, for my PhD project, I wanted to zoom out from risk and harm and look at these senses of place among young people. And, you know, of course, you heard about overdoses and somebody, you know, might have had an overdose, but a fatal overdose was relatively rare amongst those I knew. It happened. But, you know, fast forwarding to kind of the years immediately leading up to 2016, like sort of, you know, like 2015, especially, things just looked so dramatically different. And I do remember sort of 2011, 2012 when fentanyl was coming onto the scene, but people didn't even really know, like at least the young people I was working with didn't even really know what was going on. They just said, the heroin's getting so good. I'm so addicted to heroin now again, or my addiction is so much bigger than it used to be. Like the heroin's everywhere and it's getting so good. I remember people reflecting on that. And that moment is, of course, in the book as well, where we had this kind of shift. And what's so devastating is that actually really coincided with when people were moved into supportive housing and became more isolated. And so we had like the heroin getting really good because whether people knew it or not, there was fentanyl in there. And so it was way stronger. And we had people moving into these settings where they were more isolated. And so, you know, the years went on from there and we started to hear about way more overdoses. And, you know, the young people that I knew, you know, didn't start to die until kind of the 2015, 2016 time period. But there was a dramatic shift where suddenly you heard all the time about, you know, somebody overdosing. And it was, I mean, it has been absolutely devastating to go through this for anyone who is a person who uses drugs or anyone who works really closely with people who use drugs. It was unimaginable when I started this project to think there's going to be this toxic drug crisis and most of the people you know are going to die, you know, by the time you finished a book about this. It's completely devastating. And to have that sort of play out over a period of research is just like you would never anticipate it. And like I said, I had a completely different book planned in so many ways. And now, of course, part of the book title is Living and Dying Young in Vancouver. And it was horrifying to have to add that to the title. And yet, you know, I could never have written any other book because this is what happened. And this project became about these dreams of place that honestly were cut short because of the toxic drug supply. And so, you know, one thing that I really want the book to achieve is to evoke the impact of this crisis on people, on young people who use drugs, like to evoke, like, this is what we've lost. These are incredibly young people whose lives were cut short. So I hope that the book achieves that, like both remembers them and underscores the impact of this crisis. Because for the however many young people are in that book, there are, you know, thousands who aren't there at this point who have also passed away.
Is there anything else you'd like to bring to the conversation today?
No, I think these were great questions. And like I said, it means so much that you read my book and engaged so closely with it and are talking about it with other people. That really means a lot to me, and especially outside of Vancouver, because I really, the young people I work with now, they always emphasize that young people in Vancouver are not just from Vancouver. They're from all over the province. They're from the island. They're from, you know, other places in Canada. And so sometimes people say, oh, you know, Vancouver gets so much attention and there's so much work focused on Vancouver. But these young people's stories extend beyond Vancouver. And so it's really means a lot to speak with you.
Dania Fast is a medical anthropologist, an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at UBC, and a research scientist with the BC Center on Substance Use. Her book, The Best Place, Addiction, Intervention, and Living and Dying Young in Vancouver, is published by Rutgers University Press. That is it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. I want to give a big thank you to Dania Fast for taking the time to speak with me. If you liked that interview and you want to share it with someone else in your life, you can find it on our People First Radio podcast feed. Just search People First Radio on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. You can also check us out on Twitter at PeopleFirstRad. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.